Hello, welcome to Open Sources Guelph here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. I'm Adam A. Donaldson of Guelph Politico. Joining me, of course, is...
Scotty Hertz from the Hertz Bunker. And Adam, just wanted to say, busy day for you. First CBC in the morning, and then this in the afternoon, and
yeah,
no partying tonight, I guess, right? That'll have to wait.
Well, all my parties are invite only, and it's only me, myself, and I. So, I mean, there is a pandemic on. This isn't Texas.
No, there's always Zoom, I suppose, right? But it's not the same.
No.
Although, but I can always, with this, you know, our remote broadcast. So.
Well, that's true. I could always throw up that that picture of me staring intently into the camera, and it looks like I'm there, so that I can always, you know, take a nap or something.
Well, photo.
Yeah.
100 cigarettes in my mouth. No.
None of that. That's your picture.
Yeah, some truth to that.
Open Sources is CFRU's political and current affairs discussion show, and you can find us here every Thursday at 5 p.m. as we talk about the latest news items from Guelph, Ontario, Canada, and around the world. And we sometimes interview local newsmakers and politicians, which this week will be the Emerge Guelph Climate Change Hero of 2021, Dr. Pierre Fogel, who will be joining us to talk about the greater White North and working on climate change and working with climate scientists way up at the Arctic Circle, 80 degrees north latitude, if that means anything to you. So we will have that in the back half of the show. Before that, though, we're going to talk about the murder of Jamal Khashoggi, who we now definitely know was killed at the order of the Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. But what is the United States going to do about that? But first, we have political issues here in Alberta to discuss. One, Jason Kenney, he was elected in 2019 to be the man to restore Alberta to its prosperousness, if that's a word.
It is now.
It is now. But... that has not turned out to be the case. And I was looking at the Main Street poll, Scotty, the last poll done on in terms of approval ratings. And the NDP is now at 48% against the UCP, which is at 31%. So if you're Rachel Notley, there's big schadenfreude in your house right now.
I didn't realize it was that high. That's quite the number. I thought of that too when Naheed Nenshi was talking about the Alberta budget, which is something else we're going to talk a bit about, and he called it a caretaker budget. And I'm not sure whether he was just trying to, I guess he's not really hiding the fact a caretaker budget is either two things. It's like you're either saying that this you're going to ride out COVID and everything else that's going on, or there's a regime change in the future, right? So They're just doing a caretaker budget because they might get their clocks cleaned in the next election. And there is a lot of disappointment, let's say, in the Kenney regime. Of course, he's the tendency for everyone these days is to blame COVID. Something doesn't go right, or something does go right, but it's COVID. But Kenney still also has that tendency to try and beat on the Trudeau Liberals as much as he can whenever he can.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, some of the times that he does that is to do with vaccines. Other premiers have taken that tack as well, where they just conveniently start saying, well, but the government in Ottawa, they just take any opportunity to do that. And it doesn't look good after a while.
Mm.
And something else that doesn't look good for them is their, we know they've always been in this kind of holy pursuit of deficit slaying as conservatives, but the, I believe the deficit that's projected with this budget is $18.2 billion, which is really, really high and probably way higher than they wanted it to be.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, using excuses, as I had said, like COVID and just blaming lots of things that could be within their control, not just COVID, but they're still sticking a bit to the approach, let's say, of cuts, because they use the word, I think the exact quote was, delivering services more efficiently. Which is code for cuts, right?
Yeah.
And that's,
yeah.
That's something that we, you would expect them to do. It's, they're not advertising it too much. And in fact, I think some of the more significant cuts weren't even discussed when the budget was being presented. So, you know, in some way they're sticking to the guns in some ways. And in other ways, it's like the fact that they're letting the deficit be as high as it is unusual, let's say.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, part of that is, it is in the budget there. I mean, there was $126 million for, decreased granting to universities and post-secondary institutions in Alberta. I mean, that seems like a pretty large number when you're talking about post-secondary education and you're wanting to get people educated and perhaps getting jobs in the new economy. And then they're introducing this new curriculum for K-8, K-12 students. And the teachers' unions in Alberta were saying, well, you're introducing a new curriculum next year, but we have, there was nothing announced in the budget for training teachers on the new curriculum, or it didn't seem like there was an announcement about funds for new textbooks or new the new teaching materials. So we're launching a new curriculum. We don't know what's in it or how teachers will get up to date on it. And then there's a line in there about, let me see if I can find it in my notes, about that there will be, the money needed to get to make sure teachers have everything they need for the fall, but there's no line item attached to it. It's like, we're going to give teachers everything they need to be able to teach students, and then there's no cost attached, which would be weird enough, but this is the budget, so you have an item in the budget that says we're going to do X, but we're not writing how much we're going to spend on that in this line item. So it you know, even in this, I guess Naheed Nenshi's right. It does seem like a caretaker budget, in that we're taking care not to not to overwhelm people with some facts and figures that they might find otherwise disturbing, and thus, you know, further inflate the budget, or perhaps further indicate how we're spending money on things like new curriculum in a time when there's, you know, a global pandemic and economic downturn.
That is the kind of thing that just sounds good, and I'm surprised they didn't say it'll be revenue neutral, which means you do it. you just
that's
do it.
Right.
But they did put some hard numbers on what you mentioned, the university cuts,
yeah,
and or let's call it post-secondary cuts, and that was fairly significant, and it does seem targeted in a way. So it was 170 million over 2.5 years, and this I don't think this was specifically meant, this came out after the fact, this is from media reading the budget. University of Alberta is going to be like half of those cuts, half of the money or more will be just strictly University of Alberta, which is in based in Edmonton, which is an NDP hotbed. And this is the kind of thing that speaks to their base, because, you know, they've said time and again, it's like, well, we can't really afford you. We can't afford your wages. There's going to be a cut of 750 jobs. I wasn't certain whether that was just at the University of Alberta, which is the largest, of course, or across the board. But that's the kind of thing, you know, it leans into that whole, well, it was, we, you know, we need to take these Marxist lecturers to task kind of thing without actually saying it, right? We're just going to beat on you. No one's going to care because you make too much money. And you're on the, I don't know, do they have the Sunshine List in Alberta? Probably, right? Oh, those overpaid professors, just get rid of them.
Great. That's a great question now.
Yeah. But they're pinning a lot of the recovery on the, once again, the seesawing higher oil and gas price. You know, will it go higher? Is it going to stay the same? Is it going to go low? This is a province that still doesn't have a sales tax, and they never want to talk about that, even though it has been suggested if they just made it 1 or 2% or something, you know, something workable that might not lead most of Alberta to freak out, then it could go a long way to helping. But instead, they're just sort of pegging it all on, well, oil price of oil is bound to go up. And this just keeps going back and forth, right? It's like, it might go up, it might not.
There was a line in the budget that was like, you know, we're looking to the future once COVID is gone and crude is back up. And it's like, dude, like, if we're going to be choosing between those two things, only one of those is likely. And it's not the one about crude. And, you know, when you have Morgan Stanley making the point, like, they had a report that said internal combustion engine vehicles will be money-losing propositions by 2030. Mm-hmm. And yet, one of these analysts saying, and this is a direct quote, that oil companies and automakers are facing a situation that is, quote, eerily reminiscent of the thousands of buggy and whip companies that went obsolete in the early 20th century. And so, but I mean, and this is not hard to find, right? That there was a car company, I think it was Volvo. But I could be wrong, but there was a car company that announced the other day that they were going to be phasing out gas engines by 2030. Mm. There's that number again, 2030. You have Morgan Stanley saying 2030, you're going to be losing money on oil. You're going to be losing money on internal combustion engines. And then you have this car company saying, yeah, we're by 2030, we're not going to be in the business of creating gas vehicles anymore, which means they're putting their money in electric, their R&D into electric. And you got to figure in 8 years, or we're probably, with almost all the car manufacturers now investing in electric, there's probably going to be some pretty big leaps in battery tech by 2030. That is, I mean, because the big thing that's holding back electric right now is distance. You can't drive cross country on an electric vehicle without recharging it several, at least every, you know, couple of hundred kilometers, which is a brutal proposition. But if that battery can last longer, look out, it's the end of the road for oil. But this is Alberta now. Their money is oil. They're doubling down on oil. And I mean, at this point, even the money people are like, this is going to kill you economically. Pivot now, pivot now, pivot now.
Yeah, like the pivoting of the blacksmiths in 1920, right? You guys need to do something else now because the horseshoes are passe. Yeah, so they are at that point. And they gambled quite a bit on the Keystone XL, sinking a lot into that and losing big time. So that's another divot in the whole scheme of things, I guess. But something that's kind of related to oil and gas, too, is, and there was an article about this week, about the emptiness of the office buildings in Calgary. Mm-hmm. If you want office space, go to Calgary because there's lots of it. I'd heard upwards of there's 20 office towers empty or varying degrees have emptied out. And there was a bit of back and forth about this, going back to Nancy again, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And the government is pretty adamant. The provincial government is pretty adamant that, well, that's actually a municipal issue. It's nothing to do with us. The buildings are empty because oil is failing, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
These companies have left. Some of them have gone to the States. Some have gone elsewhere. So that's like an echo of the bust, right? It's what do you do with these office towers? And something was weird too. Also in the budget was about how they're going to, they're committing a bunch of money to building a new, I think it's a new courthouse.
Mm-hmm.
But they're leasing space from a building, one of these buildings that was emptied out because the company left. I can't remember the name of the place. It's like, if you want to save money, why wouldn't you just keep leasing the building and everything set up in it until further notice? And in some ways, I guess, help out with capacity there. Right. So some of the moves that they're making are kind of odd. Same with infrastructure. There's this a bit of a sleight of hand with infrastructure money, how they're giving it a massive boost. Or planning to this year, but then you know the grants further in subsequent years are actually a cut. So in this year it looks great, and they're saying, "Yeah, infrastructure money, we're going to do all of these things." But if you do the total math on the numbers that they presented, it actually, I think it's the capital grants are it works out to a cut in the long run. So it's something that looks there's a big number initially, and then it gets much smaller than they would have gotten. In a regular year. So there's some of that going on too. It's like, we'll just do this because it looks good for this year. Maybe they're hoping that people aren't going to pick it apart or something like we right. are, but not right. our province. It's still interesting to see.
Right, not our province. But I mean, it, at the end of the day, to go back to your first point, Alberta is the place that which drives a lot of let's call it Trudeau resentment. Mm-hmm. And there was a Rex Murphy article that said, I think the headline was something to the effect of Trudeau loves creating jobs in Quebec only. And it's like, well, no, but if, Alberta was interested, because, the federal government's giving a lot of support to Alberta. It bought the frickin' pipeline. It bought, we're talking about millions and millions of dollars in tax credits and employment insurance and all that. If Alberta really wants to create jobs, they really need to pivot away from oil. And that seems, and even the Calgary Chamber of Commerce is saying that. Last time we talked about Alberta politics, I mentioned that press release from the Calgary Chamber of Commerce that said, like, we need to pivot away from oil and invest in, other emerging technologies and industries. And to bring this back to politics, the other thing I'll mention is that Alberta went back to the UCP because, A, it was like a United Conservative Party, so there was no vote splitting, but also on the promise that you just needed a conservative government to get that oil revenue, pumping in again. And if this trend continues and we get to 2023, when the next Alberta provincial election, and the money isn't flowing in again, one of the reasons why the NDP is so far out in front right now is because there's an entity called the IPA that has 10% of the vote in that Main Street poll. Any idea what IPA stands for?
It's not the beer, obviously. But...
No, it's the Independence Party of Alberta.
Oh.
So.
Sucking some votes away.
Yeah, so the crazies have abandoned ship, and so you have to wonder.
Yeah, what about Rex Murphy, too, because he was pretty much a paid shill for petroleum for a while there, right? I don't know if he still is. He hasn't gotten out of that groove yet, but maybe that's topic for another day.
Well, I mean, I think about that line about where Michael Caine talked about Jaws of Revenge and how it didn't hurt the second story he put on his house. I think Rex Murphy feels the same way about the money he took from the oil industry, whether he's still making it or not.
Pipeline to his office, yep.
That's right. So speaking of oil, we now go to Saudi Arabia, where there's a man named Mohammed bin Salman, who's the crown prince, very likely to be the next ruler of Saudi Arabia. The State Department in the United States released a report that the previous administration would not release. The Biden administration took steps to finally release it, unequivocally laid the blame for the murder and, frankly, gruesome dismemberment of a Washington Post reporter and Saudi dissident Jamal Khashoggi at the feet of Mohammed bin Salman, MBS, to his friends. And now the question is, what does the Biden administration do about MBS? Because people are already kind of criticizing the Biden administration for not doing much, even after releasing the report.
Yeah, there's been talk about a recalibration, I think was the word Jen Psaki used at the press conference regarding this. The U.S. could ask for a few things. One thing that they have done is Biden and company have said, we're finished in Yemen. Mm-hmm. We're not going to back that proxy war anymore. A complicated topic front of the day that we've talked about before, but the proxy war is the Houthi rebels, presumably backed by Iran, being fought by Saudi Arabia, and America was involved with this as well. They're taking a step back from that. But directly to Khashoggi, some of the things that have been rumored to might happen is that they would ask of the still the king, Salman mm-hmm. himself. Does Ben mean son? I think so, right? Son of Solomon? Because it's still King Solomon, but Ben Solomon is Junior. Should I just call him mm-hmm. Junior?
Seems it could be. It could be.
There's some sort of naming convention there that I couldn't quite figure out. But anyway, they may ask for him to be demoted and say, can you get him out of the way and put somebody else into the fray? But there's a bit of a, like an internecine battle going on, I think, with the Saudi monarchy, and Khashoggi may have been collateral damage in that because there's been fighting amongst them as to who for supremacy. Mohammed bin Salman is obviously the dominant one and has been for the past few years. But yeah, the pretty gutsy, this hit squad business, like it was obvious to everyone that it had to have been the Saudi higher up in the Saudi regime that did it, because, you know, you walk into the embassy in Turkey, you don't walk out again. What is the hit squad called? They presumably called the Tiger Squad. And there is a Canadian connection to this too. I think it's, what is the name? You probably know the name of the documentary, Adam. Is it The Dissident that is coming out or is out that sort of covers this and the Canadian connection? An ex-intelligence officer named Saeed Al-Jabri, who is in Canada. This was the guy, and this was around the same period too when they took out Khashoggi. They came to Canada and got stopped by some border security that thought, there's something amiss here, and turned these people back, learning later that they are actually an extension of this the hit squad that took out Khashoggi. I'm sure there's some of the players overlap. They came saying, oh, they're just tourists, but they really wanted to get this Al-Jabri person. Mm-hmm. And things that have happened to him, his family kidnapped, family detained. They've been tortured in Saudi Arabia. So this is how they deal with their dissidents and anybody that stands up against the regime. So how do you deal with that? You can, are they going to get a pass on Khashoggi because there's too much at stake economically? Or, yeah, I'm not really sure how they're going to proceed with this without upsetting the Saudi monarchy too much, either economically or just in their approach to things, let's say.
Mm-hmm.
The geopolitics of it.
Right. And we also have to keep in mind that there have been 8 people in Saudi Arabia who have been convicted of this. Of killing Jamal Khashoggi, including 5 people who got sentences of over 20 years. So it's not just a matter of that he sent the hit team in. It seemed to be with the understanding that they were also going to have to do some time for it. I mean, so this is kind of remarkable. Or they set up patsies, and these aren't the guys who were put on trial are not the real guys who did the actual killing. I mean, who knows? There are no... Well, I assume there are cameras in the Saudi embassy in Istanbul, but none that anyone of any
mysteriously
of any
turned off authority. Right when this happened. Right. It's like we don't know where the file is.
Right, exactly. And there was the famously, to show how like kind of vicious this was and how much pre-planning went into this, there was a Khashoggi stand-in where one of the team members like took Khashoggi's clothing and his accessories, like his watch, and then put on a fake beard and walked out of the back door of the embassy and then down the street to the mosque, where they went into the bathroom, took off Khashoggi's clothes and the beard, and then walked out again. And then a couple hours later, this guy was filmed like yucking it up with somebody else. So I mean, to demonstrate the full like callousness and heartlessness of these people. But yeah, The Saudis put out a statement after the report was dropped. It's like, dude, this is a done deal. We got the guys that killed Jamal Khashoggi. We put them on trial and everything, and now they're in jail. And so, I mean, they're remarkably unconcerned about what's going to happen next. And I'm of two minds of this, because I understand like the Biden administration being like a normal presidential administration isn't going to like do weird random stuff because the president is an impulsive wacko. So,
or is their friend?
Or is their friend too? Yeah, that's
Trump
the other
was
part
pretty
of it.
Tight with this gang, I believe, right?
Right, keeping open future business opportunities and that.
Yeah, it's all about business. Doesn't matter the casualties right. are, right?
Yeah, well, at least for Jared. but. Yeah. But yeah, the this is a different administration, so there could be very well be decisions being made about possible directions to take later. But I also heard an expert in Saudi Arabia saying, you want to hit MBS where he lives. It's like, don't cancel his visas because he doesn't care. He can, you know, he's a crown prince. He can have, you know, stuff brought to him and he doesn't have to leave Saudi Arabia. He lives in opulence and crapulence. Mm-hmm. Cancel the weapons contracts because that's what they care about.
And that's it. Yeah. And Canada's tangled up in that too.
Absolutely.
In that, well, I'd heard, I think it was Mark Garneau had said, oh, we need an independent inquiry on this. And if there's anything we love in Canada, it's committees and inquiries. But that doesn't do, it doesn't do anything for the, I think it's $15 million, mm-hmm. $15 billion arms deal that, that Canada has. Now, I think the pledge was, well, we're going to freeze it, but that's on new permits. So that's saying that the existing ones are going to keep rolling. Supposedly, what Canada sells them, which I think is the lab vehicle, special vehicle, is only supposed to be used domestically. But of course, they've appeared in the Yemen battle I mentioned earlier. That, you know, if you give a country weapons, they're not just going to remain content. Well, we're just going to use them for crowd control in Saudi Arabia. They don't even let women drive cars. Like,
well, they do.
There is an open demonstrations. Like, you know, you're not going after them with a lab vehicle, that they're a weapon of war, right? So, and that's the tightrope, I guess, that the current administration is walking on. I don't think they're going to cut that deal loose. There's already been a hubbub about it. They're made in London, right? So it's significant, significant money. Because I think the U.S. trade with Saudi Arabia is $28 billion. So a $15 billion arms deal for Canada is fairly significant in the scheme of things, so I don't think
they're going to wait till it's done.
Because they're saying, "Oh, we just sell them the vehicles, and then they do what they want with them." But that's, you know,
because we know what they do with them because we've seen them in action. But
they're equipped that you can like bolt more guns and stuff to them, right? So that
right. The argument is like we just sell them the vehicles, and you know they're multilateral. They're utilitarian. They can do whatever they need to do. You don't have to. Right. They're a Jeep
with armor plating. Yeah.
You know, you can put canoes on the roof and take them to the river for the weekend, which is not what they're doing in Saudi Arabia or Yemen or wherever they're deploying
And Yemen's machines. A mess. Like there's civilians getting killed. There's like supposedly 2 million people starving right now. Do we just look the other way and say, let's form a committee and let's talk about it? Maybe we'll talk about it so much that we won't be the government anymore and then somebody else can worry about it, right? Because that's the attitude. They're just hoping, and I mean Canada, is just hoping that this will go away and we'll focus, which we have been, on the U.S. approach to it. I think the U.S. has frozen permits as well, haven't they, on weapon sales? So these are some of the strings that they're pulling, but you know, we'll... Again, going back to the Khashoggi question, will there be justice for him and his family? I personally don't think so. Sadly.
Sadly. Well, we'll have to go away for a minute and take a quick musical break. You are listening to Open Sources Guelph. You're on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus, and Community Radio.
It's good to be Alberta bound. Old skyline of Toronto is something you'll get on to, but they say you got to live there for a while. And if you got the money, you can get yourself a honey with a written guarantee to make you smile. But it's snowing in the city and the streets are brown and gritty, and I know there's pretty girls all over town, but they never seem to find me, and the one I left behind me, reason that I'll be Alberta bound, Alberta bound, Alberta bound.
And that was our Royal Cat Records pick of the week. Royal Cat Records on Macdonnell Street in beautiful downtown patio-filled Guelph. That was Gordon Lightfoot singing back in the days when everybody was running out to Alberta, Alberta Bound. A Canadian classic. At some point, I think it was like every song was, you should go to Alberta and make your... $500,000. Live like a king. But now... Yeah.
Not unrelated. We got the chance this week to talk to Dr. Pierre Fogel, who is this year's Climate Change Hero for Emerge Guelph, and Dr. Focal will be receiving that honor later tonight in a special virtual ceremony being hosted by Emerge. He did, however, agree to talk to me for our show earlier this week, and so let me just press play here on my interview with Dr. Focal. Well, Dr. Pierre Focal, thank you so much for joining me today.
Hello. It's nice to be here.
Well, we're glad to have you, and let me just first ask, how does it feel to be a climate change hero, to be an award-winning climate change hero at that?
Oh, it's quite surprising, actually. I don't expect to receive accolades from anywhere. Mine is not a particularly visible position, shall we say. So most of what I do today is in helping other people do things that that they'll get accolades for. So it's surprising and somewhat enjoyable.
Mm-hmm. Can you describe your position a bit? Because you run the Pearl, you're the site manager for the Pearl station, part of the Canadian network, and I'm reading it, so I make sure I get it right. The Canadian Network for the Detection of Atmospheric Change, or CANDAC. Can you talk a bit about that work? Like, what does that entail on a daily basis for you?
Okay, so CANDAC was well described by the principal investigator of it for a long time, James Drummond, as a coalition of the willing. So it's a group of like-minded scientists at Canadian universities, primarily with some participation from government scientists in Canada and the U.S., and some colleagues from around the world. And our primary site is the Polar Environment Atmospheric Research Laboratory, PEARL. And PEARL itself has three separate sites at which we have something like 30 different instruments making measurements. Some are completely different from each other, some are complementary. And at PEARL, there is usually a PEARL operator, a person whose job it is to look after these instruments 24/7, 365, well, when we're able, 365. And my job is to help them, the PEARL operator, and to organize the general goings-on at PEARL. So I'm there typically for new instrument installations. I interface with scientists who are going to bring the instruments in. Sometimes I act as an operator for a little bit here and there to fill in the gaps. Sometimes I act as a scientist to look at the data from the instruments. So I kind of, I think of myself as the guy who's going to do the things that need to get done to make it work.
Mm-hmm. All the things a manager is sort of expected to do, except your work involves climate research. And do you do research of your own on climate change?
Well, what I do is I'm a physicist at the University of Toronto Department of Physics, and so I make measurements of the atmosphere and I analyze those measurements. The results of that analysis is often, or can be used, I should say, rather than often, can be used as inputs to, global climate models and global chemistry models. So I make a contribution, I'll say that. my primary area of research is infrared spectroscopy. So I work on deducing the quantity and the identity of molecules that are in the atmosphere.
Okay, good. I did have a question here about, because I did go to the CANDAC website and I read the bio you have there. And one of my questions was, can you explain your research like I'm dumb? And you just did that, so I appreciate that. I guess one of the things in looking at what's happening with climate change right now, before I get to that, let me just ask you, to tell the listeners where PEARL is located in terms of like relative to the north, because it's pretty far north, but I want you to explain it.
Okay. Yeah. So I'll look at it from a couple of different perspectives. The first statement I'll make is it's 1,000 kilometers from the North Pole.
Mm-hmm.
So that is what, roughly the distance from kind of here to Montreal, 7,000 kilometers, maybe not quite.
Well, it's a good ballpark though.
Yeah. the second thing I'll say is that it takes 2+ days to get there on aircraft.
Mm-hmm.
And so we fly from here to somewhere like Edmonton or Calgary, from there to Yellowknife, and from Yellowknife we charter an aircraft to Eureka, where we're located. The third thing is a, you know, kind of geographical description. It's on Ellesmere Island on Slidre Fjord. It's about halfway up the island, give or take, on a small fjord that comes in from Eureka Sound. It's at roughly 80 degrees north. So some of our facilities are slightly south of that. One of them is slightly north of that. And it is one of the four remaining high Arctic, three remaining high Arctic weather stations.
Mm-hmm. So in other words, a place very few people will ever see.
It's difficult to get there. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. It's difficult to get there, and probably a place that very few people will see.
Mm-hmm. I was reading about the site too. I think it was an interview with you actually, but I mean, people may perhaps don't appreciate just how cautious you have to be when you're that far north. That if, and I think it was something you said, like if you need medical attention, that's like a day away.
Yes.
So, you know, you have to, it's not just a matter of being a really good scientist that you get access to these sites. You have to be really on top of making sure you don't trip over your own feet, which is why I'm automatically out if I ever have the chance.
Yeah. So it's a minimum, effectively a minimum 18-hour call out if you need to go to the hospital. That's how long the ambulance would take to get there. Mm-hmm. The ambulance in this case will be an aircraft. And of course it will be rather expensive.
Mm-hmm.
So I remind people of exactly that, you know, that you're literally one step from disaster, at any given time. You know, if you get a cold, okay, no big deal. Other than the fact that you'll then, antagonize everybody else on the station, because when one person gets cold, everybody gets
the cold. Right. Right.
because it's such an insular community. You know, if you nick your finger, okay, you know, we can do lots of kind of first aid things.
Mm-hmm.
But if you, you know, if you get really sick or really injured, it is a big problem very, very quickly.
It makes me think, too, given we're in the middle of a global pandemic now, you have to be doubly sure about, you know, going up as far as the Pearl or any of these stations, because if you come down quite sick with something like COVID, and because of the close quarters too, I mean, what are the health precautions like now?
Well, they're quite stringent. You know, so we left Pearl basically at the height of the pandemic last March. So 11 months ago, at the end of March. And we have not been able to return since. So we would need to return to receive a critical personnel designation from the government and have buy-in. You know, the Eureka Weather Station is run by Environment and Climate Change Canada, so a branch of the federal government, and their requirements are quite strict. We also have to satisfy the requirements of the government of Nunavut, and their requirements are also fairly strict. And it would basically require a 14-day isolation before we get on the plane to go, and then a 14-day isolation once we're there.
Mm-hmm. I can't imagine that's practical, though. I mean, is there space for isolation at Pearl?
There is with some creative thinking.
Okay.
Where it falls apart, I mean, if we're the only ones requiring it, it's okay. You know, we can make that work. But if Eureka, given where it is and having a very good runway, means that people that are working elsewhere in the Arctic occasionally wind up there due to weather.
Right.
And that's when it becomes a challenge, because then the limited capacity for isolation is evaporated.
Mm-hmm. I do want to make sure we hit the research itself. One of the things I've heard from climate change researchers is that if you want to see the effect of climate change on the planet, the best place to do that is the North. How true is that in your experience?
Well, you know, both polar regions, but yes, that is very true. There's a couple of reasons for that. One, the atmosphere is cleaner there, so you can see small changes more easily. You know, we can look at the temperature records and the landform changes, and we can see the signatures there as well. It's not getting as cold in the winter. You know, there's a lot of melting going on of the permafrost. You know, some of this is, of course, natural because, as one glaciologist reminded me, it's been melting since the end of the last ice age.
Mm.
But the rate of melting is certainly fairly substantial in some years compared to what we experienced in previous decades.
So that's the key difference, then, is like the rate of speed. And I take it that can be measured. Like, you can measure how quick melting happened hundreds of years ago versus how quick melting is happening now, and that's maybe some research people are doing.
There are probably people making those kinds of measurements. I deal with the atmosphere. So
you deal with the atmosphere, fair enough.
Not the ground. What one problem that we have is that we've only really been making measurements in that part of the Arctic for about 60-70 years.
Mm.
So there's not that long-term a record. But, you know, we do know that the Arctic is warming about three times faster than mid-latitudes, for example.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we can see that change.
Mm-hmm. And how does that, I mean, is that like an indicator, like trends that you're seeing in the North are trends that can affect this down here? Like, how does a change in the atmosphere in one section of the planet tell us about coming changes at the other sections?
It's not easy to draw a straight line between the two, but mm-hmm. but you can, you know, we're on this sphere, the Earth, and the atmosphere is continuous, right? So a change, you know, it's like a if you had a bucket of water and you stir in one part of the bucket, the water in the whole bucket moves, right? So as the atmosphere changes over the poles, then those changes do propagate to the rest of the atmosphere.
Mm-hmm.
We see that in not only in things getting warmer, but in weather patterns changing from what we're used to. Again, it's not easy to draw a straight line, but, you know, major weather events could quite easily have some connection to changes in the polar regions.
Mm-hmm. I guess that's part of the difficulty of this is that I guess we expect science to give us hard answers and to draw those straight lines. And what I always hear from scientists is that, you know, we can make observations, we can draw conclusions, but those are, you know, kind of drawn from what we understand at the moment, and we're always expanding our understanding, so there are really no firm lines. And I guess that's maybe part of the issue in selling some people on the need for climate action.
That's no doubt, yes, that's no doubt true.
Yeah.
The thing to remember though about a scientific conclusion is that it generally comes with some sort of uncertainty attached to it.
Mm-hmm.
So you know, you can get a scientist such as myself. I'd say, well, you know, I made this measurement and here's my conclusion. And, you know, my error bars are 20%. Well, you can look at that two ways. You can say that, well, that's an uncertainty of 20% and you know, that's too much. Or you can look at it as saying, well, it's 80% likely.
Right.
You know, yes, there is a lot of uncertainty in the fine detail of many of these things, and the kicker about the climate problem and the impacts are that it's often the fine details that we experience.
Mm-hmm.
People will perhaps quite rightly get upset at the fact that no one told them that, that, you know, their life would be affected this way. You know, for example, snow in Texas, if that, you know, is quite possibly a result of changes in the polar circulation. Mm-hmm. But, you know, you can't predict from understanding that the circulation is changing, that it might be a degree colder in Texas than you expected. And that might make the difference between snow and rain.
Right. And I mean, that was interesting a couple of weeks ago when that weather event happened, because I remember seeing like a temperature map and it looked like a cold sandwich, right? It looked like right down the middle of North America, it was cold. And then there were warmer temperatures on the sides. I can't remember ever seeing a weather map like that.
I don't know that I ever have either.
Yeah.
I won't pretend to understand why that happened, but it did happen. And that cold air came from the Arctic, and you know, why specifically did it come from the Arctic? You know, breakdown of the polar vortex to a sudden stratospheric warming. You know, we could say things like this, but does that help anyone, you know, in that cold path?
Yeah,
probably not. So that's one of the challenges that we face in bringing home the reality of these changes.
But at the same time, though, in so much as scientists are, you know, creating models and coming up with theories about what's going to happen as a result of climate change, you know, the models have more or less stayed the same. What I have heard climate scientists say is, like, our models were right. What we got wrong is the timetable. It's actually going faster than we anticipated, too.
Well, I think that if we could predict the stock market as well as we could predict the climate, we'd probably make a lot of money.
That's right.
I mean, I think, again, in the kind of the macroscopic level of things, the climate models are really pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
And again, this is outside my realm of expertise. I'm relating this as an interested observer. but you know, it's the fine details again that is what we notice day to day. You know, it's a scary thought to consider that, yes, the timetable might be wrong, and it might be wrong in the wrong direction, if you will, making it all happen quicker.
Mm-hmm. Can you see it? Like, can you see the changing climate just by, you know, walking out? I don't know if the Pearl has a front door, but I imagine it does have a door. But can you, like, go out? Or even when you kind of get there and get off the plane, can you see the effect on the climate? Like, is it that observable?
No, it isn't. You know, the place doesn't look that different year to year. You see indicators like the ground ice melting. And that, you know, might mean there's a pothole in the runway or something like that. Or something that's happened to us a few times is the culverts in our road have been washed out by a combination of, mudslides and extra water.
Mm-hmm.
So there are things like that we experience, but it's not like I step out of the plane the next time I go up and all of a sudden, you know, there's, it's greener or something like that.
Right.
Yeah, at least not so far.
It just strikes me that, you know, a lot of people who may have, let's say, hesitancy about the science, a lot of people generally are kind of visual learners. And if you could, you know, hold up a before and after picture, you know, that is kind of more persuasive than scientific models and, you know, that kind of data-driven research.
Yeah. And I mean, there is... if I remember correctly, an effect going on that is referred to as the greening of the Arctic.
Mm.
You know, you can see leafy plants moving further north if you look at, you know, albedo measurements and things like that. How quickly is that going? I can't recall. And can you make a four-color picture that has everyone going, ooh, okay, well, now we really see it? And again, it comes back to the everyday experience. You know, that's happening there, not here. So, right. how much do you really expect me to worry about that when I've got all these other things to worry about day in and day out?
Right.
So it's a difficult problem to solve, how to get everybody on board to make the changes that we're going to require.
It's interesting to hear you talk about what keeps you up at night, because that was actually another one of my questions is, I mean, you're kind of, you've been up there, you are helping to collect the data, you talk to the other scientists. I mean, if we're talking about climate change and ways to fight the problem, when you lay your head on the pillow at night, what negative thoughts sort of keep you up on that issue? That, yeah, I mean, maybe it's something too that you wish other people knew as well in these discussions.
to be honest, if there's things that keep me awake, it tends to be rather more mundane problems than that. how do I make this thing work again, or how do I stop it from doing that, or how do I get this person and that person to get along, and things like that tend to be the things that ruin my sleep. but you know, overall, one of the things that I remind the people that I work with is that everything has a cost. Mm-hmm. You know, this is very true in the Arctic, but it's true everywhere, that everything that you do means that something else isn't going to be done, because you know energy can neither be created nor destroyed, and the same for mass and what have you. So resources are limited, and we need to be mindful of mm-hmm. how we proceed in doing things. And small changes add up. That is also true. If you undertake to make a change to make your thing better, whether it mm-hmm. be an experiment at Pearl or your day-to-day life in Guelph, in and of itself, it's not perhaps noticeable. But if 10% of Guelph does that, then all of a sudden that's 10,000, 12,000 people, and that's different.
Right.
We're not, there's no magic wand. I don't think at this point. I mean, maybe we'll find something. Science has surprised us in the past, but at this point, there's no magic wand that, is going to solve our problems without us changing the way we do things.
I always like to ask people with expertise in this area, and maybe especially you, because being named a climate change hero, heroes are problem solvers. So perhaps we can take your point of view as maybe a measurement. Are you hopeful that we can reverse this trend of climate change, that we can, you know, start the process of righting the Earth's climate, despite all the doom and gloom predictions?
Climate is ever evolving. I don't know that I would know what the right state of climate is. I mean, the climate of the past 100 or 200 years has certainly been good for us. And can we stay here or get back to there from a future position? You know, I believe that we can come out of this. Whether that means that we evolve to meet an evolving climate, or we evolve to allow the climate to devolve back to where it was, I don't know which one of those paths is likely to happen, but I don't think that we're going to disappear. You know, one way or another, we will work our way to a place where we as humans can survive.
I think that's just the sort of honest, pragmatic answer we could expect from a climate change hero and an accomplished scientist like yourself. So we will leave it there. Dr. Pierre Fogel, thank you so much for your time.
It's been a pleasure being here with you, Adam.
So that was, once again, Dr. Fogel. Dr. Pierre Fogel, he will be getting his Climate Change Hero of the Year Award later tonight. And we once again congratulate him on all his success in working to cover our doom. You know, from climate change.
Yes. The song remains the same, but yeah, for sure.
Anyway, we'll have to leave that there for this week. We are out of time. We hope you like the show as always. You can You can stay connected to us at our website, opensourcesguelph.com. We're on Facebook at Open Sources Newswire. We're on Twitter at @OS_Guelph. To listen to the show again, you can download it from our website every Monday. You can go to the Guelph Politicast channel on Podbean, or you can get it on your favorite podcast app at Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, and Spotify. I am on Twitter and Instagram at Adam A. Donaldson. You can find my news and politics site at guelphpolitico.ca. And Scotty, where can people find you on the internet?
I am Scotty Hertz on Facebook, Scotty Hertz on Twitter. And please check out our website, the station website at cfru.ca for scheduling information and more about our show and others. It is an unlimited wealth of stuff to check out. And you can check out the archive there as well. We are literally everywhere.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I guess, you know, let's put in a quick plug for, we're going to have a museum show, CFRU is anyway, in the next couple of months. So stay tuned for that. And stay tuned for DJ Sounds Good to Me here at the top of the hour on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. We will, of course, be back next Thursday at 5 p.m. for more open sources. And we will see you then.